Hello, all. Welcome to the God Said of Us podcast. This is Patrick Barney. I'm the editor of Kai Draconis Books. Kai Draconis Books is an independent anarchist press dedicated to publishing socially conscious or socially engaged literature. We are currently accepting submissions of manuscripts for the 2020 production year. So if you are interested in, you know, trying to get your novel, collection of poems, collection of stories, collection of essays or memoirs published, you can check out our website, kaidraconis.org, kaidraconis.org, to look at our submission guidelines. Also, as a statement against commodification, all our books are free. So if, while you're on our website wanting to submit something, you see one of our books that you'd like to order, just head to our order a book page, provide all the necessary information, and we will send you a copy or copies of any books you like for free. So today, as usual, I'm with my fellow podcasters, Hans Berger and Chris Malmberg. Today we're going to talk about a kind of really interesting, really difficult, I would say it's a fairly difficult novel, a really interesting, difficult novel that kind of gets into identity politics. It's Fran Ross's Oreo, which is about a 16-year-old girl named Christine who decides, after, you know, pretty much being raised by her grandmother, who is Black, she decides that she's going to go off to New York to find her father, who she has not seen since you know, he left before she was born, or maybe at one or two or something like that. And her father is Jewish. So it's a exploration of identity and fluidity of identity, and on some level it seems to be kind of a criticism of the idea that not just that there are authentic identities, but that we would need an authentic identity. At least that's my take after, you know, reading the novel and then reading some critical literature around on the novel. And so I thought we would start with that idea. Chris and Hans, if you have an opinion, what do you think? Do you think that clearly the novel is, you know, the subject matter of the novel is identity. What do you think that it's trying to get at when we talk about identity?
Well, I mean, I think that it's interesting to kind of think about the ways in the novel that identity is, certainly it presents identity as a very constructed thing, right? But there are some ways in which identity is something that people are able to construct themselves, and there are other ways in which identity is something, a constructed thing that is externally forced upon them or pushed upon them, right? And it's interesting thing to kind of look at the ways that in some parts of the novel, the characters' identities might be something that they're able to, you know, take some kind of initiative to create for themselves. And maybe, I don't know if it's, I'm trying to think of a good example of, for instance, one of the perspectives that I read, you know, when I was reading this novel, the sequence of events is sort of a retelling of the myth of Theseus, the character in Greek mythology who slew the Minotaur. Am I saying that right? Minotaur? I've heard it both ways.
Yeah, I've heard it both ways too. I think it doesn't matter.
Okay. I usually say Minotaur for whatever reason. So
do I.
Sorry, go ahead, Chris.
I didn't say anything.
Did somebody try to butt in?
No,
you said you say Minotaur, and I said, so do I.
Okay, cool. So when Christine's father, when Christine's father tells her, Christine's father is the one who tells her mother, okay, find the sword and the sandals, and then once you've found those, you're going to embark on this journey, right? So one interpretation of that is that her father has, by pushing her to embark on this version of the myth of Theseus, he's kind of imposing this masculinized Western identity on her, right? That there's that making her participate in that narrative is a way of kind of externally imposing an identity. So the use of the myth of Theseus, partly from a craft standpoint, that's interesting because it gives the reader kind of a foothold in the events of the novel, which otherwise have kind of a free associative, picaresque feel to them. Mm-hmm. You know, but then it also is, it has kind of a quality of this thing that's imposed externally that stops Christine from being able to fully construct her own identity.
Yeah.
I don't know. Does that ring true to you guys? Bullshit.
Yeah.
Go
ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask also, does the novel deconstruct the myth of Theseus? Does it work in opposition to that? Where does it end up standing relative to that myth?
I think, yeah, that's a separate, really interesting question, given the way that the Theseus illusion is foregrounded at the end. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, my dad made this whole thing in the image of the myth of Theseus, which is a weird way of actually, like, I don't know, like, exactly if what the effect is of doing that, but it makes the... It positions the force that makes these events align with, you know, the myth of Theseus. It puts that inside of the book, rather than outside of it, as rather than a device by employed by the author, it's a device employed by a character. So I don't. Mm-hmm. No, exactly. I think that's a separate, really interesting question. I mean, going back to the question about like the identity. Man, I don't know. I couldn't really say that there was a clear statement about identity, except that look at how richly diverse, you know, this world is, or this, I guess, like these communities of people, and you know, you have little people, you've got, you know, like the is she German? The Frau, is she a German Jew that Sam Schwartz is married to or partnered with at the end?
I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah, and. You know, and she's a wackadoo witch lady, and you know, like that's barely, you have a white a white man with a huge cock who behaves like a horse. You have Parnell the pimp. I don't know, like it's just it's a really diverse, rich cast, and it seems. You know, in some ways, like the pimp is sort of a stereotype, I guess. But no one really, apart from that, it's just so diverse that I guess like that, is that a statement about identity that like, oh my God, there's just so many different types of people. I don't know. I couldn't really boil it down to a statement about identity. Does the theory do that, Patrick?
Well, yeah, the theory I read, the edition of the book I had came with a foreword and an afterword, and the theory that I read put forward the position that the novel is seeking to kind of criticize this idea of a core Black identity that the writer of the foreword suggested was kind of being sought after when the book was published. So this would have been in 1974. So, you know, the theorist argues that, you know, in 74, you know, Roots had come out, or maybe it was a year later that Roots was coming out, but that, you know, Black people needed to reconnect with African heritage. And so the theorist argues that what Ross is doing is saying that this isn't our heritage. Maybe it could have been had we maintained a connection with it over 400 years, but you know, we've been severed by it through slavery and oppression and whatnot. So now the theorist is saying that Ross is arguing that we need to reach out and construct our own identity, and carve a kind of American identity of Blackness. And, you know, she says that this could involve lots of, you know, tinkering with other cultures as Oreo does. You know, she seems fluent in French, in Yiddish. So, which I actually find extremely interesting, given that if her father, if you guys can clear this up for me, I don't quite remember when her father was no longer in her life, but super early, right?
I think even before she was born.
Right.
I don't know for sure, but that I believe before she was born.
Yeah, I believe so, before.
So, and it's interesting how much the relationship that this book has to Jewish identity in particular is very interesting, because of course the, you know, her grandfather, I'm jumping ahead a little bit to where I think you're going, but I assume that part of what you're finding interesting is that Christine, you know, she has a lot of Yiddish in her vocabulary, and
right,
if you were to take a lot of what she says in a vacuum without knowing who the character is, she talks like a stereotypical Jewish person throughout a lot of the novel. And that's interesting because her Jewish father was never present in her life.
Right, but exactly.
And it's doubly interesting because my understanding of where a lot of that comes from is her grandfather, her Black grandfather, perceives himself as having been cheated early in his life, perceived himself as having been cheated by a Jewish salesman over a pickle, and kind of made this, made a career out of trying to sell kitschy, useless things to Jewish people as kind of this elaborate form of revenge. But it one side effect of that is that to do that, he and his family have become so fluent and immersed in Jewish culture that they've ended up taking on a very Jewish identity. And that, I mean, that's my understanding of how, I don't know if that matches with your guys' understanding, but that was my sense of how Christine became so immersed in Yiddish and in all those sorts of Jewishisms that she uses.
Yeah, she's
so, I don't know what it means thematically that's the process, right? But it's a form of, it's their Jewish identity comes as the byproduct of a weird form of anti-Semitism, by my understanding.
Well, I just jump in real quick. She speaks that way, but it's also it's very performative. Like it's not, you know, and that's something that she does with, I think like you could call it ebonics, right? A couple times, but, when she's getting the, getting her father's sperm, using a script from a doctor, she just sort of becomes, you know, becomes another person briefly, a black person who can't, you know, express herself super cleanly, like, and articulately as she can normally. And she takes on like a kind of abbreviated slang speech, I guess, you know, like, you know, playing a part that allows her to get away with that. And a couple of other times too. So like, is it just that these are performative faces? Like, these are not actually reflective of who she is. They're more like things that she can just pull on and use.
Well, I definitely feel like performativity is a huge thing. And, you know, Hans, you just, you know, kind of came up with this explanation of why she'd be so fluent in Yiddish, but maybe why I didn't necessarily feel that to be a great explanation was because it seemed so performative to me, because she was able to move in and out of all these different, you know,
roles,
exactly.
Identities.
So while I definitely think that what you're saying absolutely makes sense, like, I see what you're saying, like, she inherited this ability to take on Yiddish from her grandfather, there seems to be some type of, if that causal connection is really meant to hold, then it would seem to undermine the idea that she's performing, if that makes sense. I do think she's performing. So I feel like maybe the fact that the explanation is so ridiculous is a hint that that's not the point, right? Like, you know, the grandfather, he wants to get revenge for somebody who cheated him about a pickle. So, you know, a byproduct of this is that he becomes, you know, part, you know, at least identity wise, partly Jewish. You know, that's ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is it? I mean, like, I don't know, because his, you know, like, his Jewishness is also performative. So what she actually, like, is what she does. So she's hired by the sound guy to do that commercial read. And it's, you know, he says that she sounds Jewish, but maybe it's not that she sounds Jewish. It's that she sounds like someone selling to Jews, you know, using a Jewish identity. Like, what she has taken from her, what she's garnered from her grandfather may not be actually reflective of a real Jewish, or, you know, like a Yiddish sort of like speech pattern. Maybe it's more reflective of a Yiddish speech pattern used to sell people on things, you know, because that's his whole thing is, you know.
Well, then, but one thing you just said is it's not reflective of a real Yiddish. So I guess one question is does the novel follow most postmodernist thinkers in thinking that there is no, you know, it's been formulated in a bunch of ways, but I'll just use the common one, that there is no transcendental signifier, that there is no core.
I'd say no, because it's hinted that, like, the sound guy connects her to her father. Okay. And if he's gone before she's born, what, you know, like, there has to be some core identity there that connects them. Is there room in postmodernism for that sort of, like, you know, like, you remind me of this man that I, you know, like, you know, that I also work with, who happens to be her father, doesn't that sort of hint at some sort of like core being that, that some core meaning that is like irreducible, like she is her father's daughter?
Maybe that depends on which postmodernist you talk to.
Yeah, maybe not. Maybe that's bullshit.
Well, and I mean, being a novel, it's, you know, it's not a philosophical text. You can, it doesn't seem inappropriate to me that there would be, you can have a novel. I mean, it can be a novel where identity is constructed and core truth is questioned. The transcendental signifier is questioned, and still admit a certain amount of, I mean, in the, you know, the real world is shady like that, is fuzzy like that. It can, I don't think it's inconceivable that it could admit a certain amount of some hint of the idea of there being, whether it's in genetics, whether it's in whatever the mechanism of transmission is, you know, the fact that, the fact that there's some part of her father's identity that's somehow carried into her through cultural transmission, through genes, through whatever, doesn't mean that identity can't also be actively constructed or, you know, deliberately constructed.
Sure, absolutely. But I feel like you were about to say something. Not to say that what you just said wasn't interesting. But I feel like you were about to say something super interesting about...
Oh, goodness.
protesting that, you know, it's a novel, it's not a philosophical text. What's the difference?
What's the difference between a novel and a philosophical text?
Yeah.
Well, I think that the difference is that... Well, that's an interesting question. I guess the point I was trying to make is that presumably at least, and I'm sure you can muddy this in all kinds of ways, but presumably you would expect something that was intended primarily as a philosophical treatise to be internally consistent, right?
Right, absolutely.
One would hope that it would be internally consistent.
Yeah, if it's not not internally consistent, it's bad philosophy.
Right. Whereas something that is, you know, if the because a novel has a lot of other aesthetic function, it has aesthetic functions, it has entertainment functions, it has narrative functions. So, you know, it might, you might have a novel that, is not conceptually or in, it's maybe more accessible for not accessible, maybe more acceptable for a novel to be less philosophically internally consistent, right?
Sure.
If there are a number of things that the writer's trying to do, or there are a number of things that a reader would be trying to extract from it, one of those might be a philosophical position on the construction of identity, but, you know, there's a lot of other things that you would be trying to either put into it or get out of it as a writer or a reader. So it,
sure.
If one part of it makes one, if there are some parts of it that are in line with postmodern ideas about identity, it's not inconceivable that there might be other parts of it that are out of line with that, and that, you know, from if your main focus is trying to find a philosophical through line about the relationship to postmodernism, you might end up just finding internal inconsistencies.
Yeah, I think like stories and story and character and other things take prominence over the, you know, the integrity of the philosophy. So it's, she, you know, is, I get, but that's an authorial intent question that, you know, maybe you can.
Well, and that's why I put the caveat in about what one would be trying to extract as a reader.
Yeah.
As well. Because
yes.
I, you know, the, I, I suppose it, you know, we have different priorities as readers. You know, I know that Patrick, you're much more capable than I am, really, in terms of thinking about novels as a philosophical argument, right? And evaluating the philosophical consistency of novels. That's not something, I mean, when I was reading this, I was more interested, for instance, in some of the wordplay, right? The Ross takes really remarkable joy in, you know, interlinguistic puns and in all sorts of...
Absolutely.
It has an immensely playful quality. I don't have any of those highlighted for examples, unfortunately, in front of me, but... and I think that to try to tie it back to the question of identity, do you guys have any thoughts about what function the wordplay of the novel has relative to its ideas about identity?
That's an interesting question. I don't know. I feel like I need to defer to Chris on this. I felt like the wordplay was interesting, but also it kind of made it difficult for me. So I didn't necessarily have many connections that sprang to my mind.
I didn't really ascribe meaning to it. It was, maybe there is more to be made of it than it just being fun. And funny, and there's, I think, like, you could say that, like, that because Oreo has games that she plays, you know, in her own head when engaging with the people around her. She names people without knowing their name.
Yeah, like Parnell, that's not his real name.
Yes. And she awards little things. She makes observations. And a lot of that seems to take place in a linguistic sort of layer that she applies to the world around her. And you could say, because one of the things about this book is that Christine is never really in danger, even when she's surrounded by really, like, grotesque, awful things. She's never, I wonder if, like, part of the reason that she never is in danger and she never really feels like she's, though briefly with Parnell and Kirk, I was horrified on her behalf and wondering, like, suddenly the novel is going to take a super dark turn.
Right. I was hoping it wouldn't.
You were hoping it wouldn't?
I was hoping it wouldn't. I did not want to see some awful rape scene of Oreo. I did not want to see that.
No, I didn't either. I was really concerned. But then, like, there's this layer that through which, like, she and we kind of interact with everyone. And it is this linguistic layer. And through language, everything is rendered as just so it's almost like a cartoon it's a cartoon and she is like the CEO of Acme. You know, like, she has full control over all of these different, like, she has a indestructible hymen, you know, like that, you know, like, I don't know. I feel like language has something to do with that and the play of language. And, you know, and if we are going to say that, you know, like, this is kind of like a construction that, like, that black, let's say young black women needed, she is really like this kind of like a Paul Bunyan. Like, she's just not real, but she's not real in a way that, like, you can take Paul Bunyan's actually the wrong one, but like she's a mythical figure that like can be like a role model for maybe young women.
And I wonder if that sense that you were picking up of the idea that she's never really in danger, and it seems like she never regards herself as being in danger. You know, she has this almost supernatural confidence. And even though we've been talking pretty critically about the role of the myth of Theseus, right? That the being that in some way there's a kind of cultural imperialism that's forced on her in being made to live out the role of Theseus. The mirror of that is that as long as she is performing that story, there's an invulnerability that comes with that, right? Because that character, his journey essentially was a series of encounters in which he fairly effortlessly triumphed. And so that myth becomes something that on the one hand has an element of, has an element of oppression to it, but then on the other hand, in a certain way has an empowering quality or a comes with it this sort of sense of inevitable invulnerability. But then again, at the end of the novel, when her father commits suicide in front of her, and she kind of shrugs off, by my reading of it at least, she kind of shrugs off his role in her life. Maybe in discarding that, is she giving up something that's been a source of, like I said, of invulnerability, or is that illusory? Is that not really something that she needed to live powerfully in the world?
Well,
I find out in the sequel.
I definitely think that, unlike the Theseus myth, which is, I've heard interpreted as like a cycle of searching for one's father. So Theseus comes back, but because of a mistake, the wrong flag is flying on his ship or something like that after he's defeated the Minotaur. And so Aegeus commits suicide. And then I've heard interpretations that Theseus after that, he's searching for his father over and over again. And that story is like mirrored in the death of his own son and, Hippolytus and whatnot. And I think it's significant that Oreo chooses, or maybe not, maybe chooses is the wrong word. Especially if we're living in a deterministic universe where nothing matters. Maybe the word is shrugs it off is better, since it's less about agency, I guess. But maybe it's important that she doesn't continue the cycle of looking for a father the way Theseus does.
She exits that myth.
Yeah, she exits.
She exits that mythical role.
Yeah, she exits the mythical role.
Yeah, I think that's a good point.
Interesting.
I had a question. This is maybe more for Hans about, like...
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Hans doesn't have any answers. He doesn't know why your life is meaningless.
Well, Patrick, sometimes...
Yeah, if you can ask me the question and then there'll be a pause while I look it up on Wikipedia. And we'll
sometimes it's not about the answers.
It's always about the answers and there are none.
That's not true.
Kill yourselves.
Oh, that's sad. I was wondering about like the ending, where Fran Ross chooses to recount the myth of Theseus and basically make that association really explicit. Like, what is that?
You mean the afterword where she just briefly explains, where she recounts the myth of Theseus and then gives a quick breakdown of which characters correspond to what.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was curious about that.
I don't know. Part of me just assumed that was functional, you know, because before I went into this novel, the only thing I knew about Theseus was the question of the ship of Theseus, right? That's the only thing I had forgotten, even that he killed the Minotaur. So
is it the same ship?
Is it the same ship? Right.
Right.
First you replace masts, then you replace the hull, then you replace all the planks in the deck. At what point does it stop being the same ship? And I mean, that quandary really has nothing to do with the actual character of Theseus. I had forgotten even that he killed the Minotaur. I'd forgotten. I'm sure that I read that myth in middle school, but my assumption was, honestly, was that it was just, she wanted to, it was meant as an aid to non-classicists, as she says. Do you guys think, were you thinking, Chris, that there might be some thematic function that served beyond just a kindly assist to the reader?
No, I guess I was wondering if there was. It just because like it's not really important.
I suppose you could.
Oreos is like, oh, Oreos' revelation is that like her whole experience has been like modeled on this mythical experience is more like, of course, you know, and kind of almost disappointed in her father's lack of like creativity.
Well, and maybe the tone, I mean, the tone in that section is so, the tone in the summary at the very end is so whimsical. Maybe whimsical is not quite the right word for it, but it has a quality of being kind of rushed through. And the myth is treated, the actual details of the myth are treated with a certain amount of dismissiveness.
Yeah.
Or was my sense of it, at least. Maybe that's part of it, is to kind of, to deflate the seriousness of the myth.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe.
Did either of you find, I don't know, I definitely found it puzzling, not necessarily problematic, but, you know, we find out at the end that Samuel Schwartz has kind of sent Oreo on this scavenger hunt or whatnot that is supposed to mimic Theseus and the Theseus myth in some way. And I was hoping maybe you could clear this up, because while earlier, Chris, you said that places the Theseus myth inside the story, right? But in contrast, this like index of characters or you know, list that, you know, tells you which character is which, kind of is a contradiction to that. It seems like if the Theseus myth is meant to be only internal to the story, we wouldn't necessarily have this index. I mean, the index, you know,
what you're saying, Patrick, if I'm understanding right, is that there's a metatextual trick where the suggestion is that the author is not the one constructing the correspondence to Theseus. The character is constructing the correspondence to Theseus. So where that mythical resonance would normally be something constructed in by an author, in this case, it's something that's added within the story by a character. And so having an omniscient author relay a key at the end kind of undermines the central metatextual trick of the novel.
Exactly. Thank you for, you know, unknotting my tongue and saying exactly what I was trying to say. Like, you know, we can see that a character is kind of putting this, is putting the Theseus myth onto Oreo, a character in the novel, but you know, it's told, like you said, by an omniscient narrator who adds this key, you know, so it seems to me that these, it just seems to me a contradiction, that's all. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if, like, this is, like, we've got this metatextual trick. Is the index another metatextual trick on top of it? Or is it, like you said, Hans, just functional? It's just there to help us out? Or is it another part of it? Is it a puzzle for us to undo?
And I'll just say, like, that same omniscient author just completely, like, and omniscient, omnipresent, all-powerful, killed off her father. You know, maybe there was a chain of I'm joking, but like maybe getting rid of loose ends. You know, maybe the dad knew about the afterword and the list. And
my instinct as a writer is to assume that it's just a functional thing that you know, Fran Ross was hoping enough that people would understand the mythical references that she just put that thing at the end to make sure that people did, in spite of, you know, undermining the metatextual trick, as we've been saying.
Yeah,
That's sort of an unsatisfying answer, and I don't have a great argument for it beyond, if nothing else, as a reader, thinking, boy, I wish more authors did stuff like this, you know?
So if that's the case, if it's a functional thing, maybe I'm just thinking too hard about this. It just seems to me that we can't actually, my intuition, my gut reaction is that this is not... never mind. I'm not sure. Like, it's too...
Well, it's a dissatisfying answer to say it's a functional thing. It kind of defeats our role as critics.
Right, yeah.
You know, it's like if you were critiquing the architecture of something and you stood around looking at a beam, arguing if the beam was... You know, one person is talking about, this beam, you know, creates, it completes this geometric shape, which has this resonance with the Kabbalah. And then the other person said, well, it's there to hold the ceiling up.
I have a kind of an unrelated question. Just what were your guys' favorite set pieces? Because it really, like, this picaresque style, like, you know, Oreo is just put into, like, these different successive situations and most of them are hilarious or weird. And I was curious, like, which one stuck out to you guys the most as just the funniest or the funnest or the coolest and why?
Well, I'm wary of calling it the coolest, but the sequence with Parnell, he has the 10 women, you know, half of them are white, half of them are black, and they walk behind him in this checkerboard line, and he has this elaborate shoeshine ritual, and he kicks each of them in the butt at the termination of, you know, their step in the process. None of that would be satisfying to watch if we didn't eventually have Oreo, of course, kicking his ass.
Right.
But that just has such a, it's like this, it, more than anything, it made me think of, like, the Madeline books, you know, with the 10 little orphan girls walking behind the nun. But it's that inverted in this kind of grotesque, you know, it's that image transported somehow into a, like, a blaxploitation movie from the 70s. And I found that, that will stick with me, if nothing else.
Yeah. And for me too, in the way that Fran Ross, like, she doesn't, like, leave it there. She, like, turns it up, like, a couple of more notches when, like, mm-hmm. the pimp opens the door and there's a wrestling mat. and another big locked door, and through that door, like a horse-like white man with a giant dong that points like a limb at all of the women, you know, like in turn, and like it's just it was really, that was so fun and crazy. I'm with you, man. That was awesome.
So anyway, have things wound down? Is there more to say?
I think, I just, practically speaking, I should probably look at trying to get away pretty soon.
Oh, okay. Cause you have that hard cutoff. Okay.
I have the hard cutoff because of the rental car.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. So awesome. All right. Well, actually, I found this a very interesting conversation. As I said, I found this to be kind of a difficult book. Definitely hilarious, definitely entertaining. You know, mm-hmm. my favorite sequence was also the Parnell sequence, the extended thing, especially the moment when, you know, he pulls back his foreskin and there's all this
smegma.
And, oh my god! You know, it has to. Yeah, it has to be cleaned. And I was like, I was both cracking up and gagging.
Oh, it's disgusting.
As I was listening to it in my car, and I'm like, Jesus, that's disgusting. And then, you know, Oreo kicks everybody's ass. And I thought, with her own invented martial arts, which I think is hilarious. So, yeah, it was a super fun book. I hope you guys enjoyed it because it was pretty
tremendously. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, good. Good. It was a lot. That's of fun. Awesome. Yeah. I'm glad that I picked something you guys enjoy, because next time I'm picking something totally dark, not going to be funny at all. You guys are probably going to hate it. But
excellent. Excellent.
Chris. So I just wanted to make sure your choice is Catch 22 by Joseph Heller, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. Catch 22.
Okay. Okay, I will start reading that. And everybody who's tuned in, that's what we're going to talk about next time, Joseph Heller's Catch 22. I hope you enjoyed our discussion on Fran Ross's Oreo. And yeah, definitely check it out, especially if, you know, you're interested in wordplay and hilarity, because it was pretty good. Okay, guys, talk to you in a couple of weeks then about Catch 22, if that sounds okay.
Sounds good to me.
Sounds good to me.
All right. Good luck on your next 2 weeks, guys. Peace out.
Yep. Peace out.
You too.